It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're taking a look at the reasoning behind yesterday's Trump's versus Hawaii travel ban decision by the Supreme Court. We're going to look at this from three different sides this hour. What do you think of the court's decision? Do Donald Trump's statements on the campaign trail that the U.S. should stop letting Muslims in the country evidence as bias, does that matter to you? 800-642-1234 is the number. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to start our examination of this case with Aziz Huq. He's a constitutional law professor and the Frank and Bernice J. Greenberg Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. Aziz, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Carrie.
So Trump's travel ban has been a long and complicated issue. How did we get to today, and what is Hawaii versus Trump?
President Trump has issued three versions of a prohibition on entry to nationals of certain countries. The first was issued in January of 2017. It was struck down. The second issued soon after. It, too, was invalidated in the lower courts. This is the third iteration. It was an iteration that went through what purported to be a process of consultation within the several cabinet departments. It was challenged. It was initially invalidated in two circuit courts of appeals. One of those cases was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday reversed the ruling of the Court of Appeals and upheld the travel ban on the ground that as the product of consultation between several different agencies on a matter of entry to the country, the ban was due deference from the courts, such that the president's statements were not relevant to the standing or the legality of the prohibition.
Now, the justices that voted in favor of Trump, they didn't say that he didn't make these statements. They just said that his statements weren't relevant to this case, correct?
That's right. Both the majority opinion by Chief Justice John Roberts and a separate concurrence by Anthony Kennedy go out of their way to acknowledge, even if briefly, the comments and statements that were made concerning the policy here. And the majority is very clear that it is not because of the statements that the ban is upheld. Indeed, there's a very telling line where Chief Justice Roberts says, look, we're not making a judgment here about the powers of a president. We're making a judgment about the powers of the presidency, the institution of the presidency. And provided that the forms of normal policymaking are followed, we will not take account of evidence of improper motive.
So what's interesting to me here is that just last week, I believe, Anthony Kennedy argued in the cake maker case in Colorado that statements by people on the commission who heard this case were biased, and that those biased statements led them to make a biased judgment, that it tainted their judgment. Why wasn't the argument the same here?
The short answer is that in cases involving immigration, national security, but also criminal law, the court has been unwilling historically to take into account evidence that, in particular, executive branch officials, but also prosecutors, are biased. And I think that the extraordinary thing about yesterday's decision is that it's one of the first instances in which there was open, public, and notorious evidence of improper motive, and the court said even when that evidence is available, even when the widely known social meaning of a measure is discriminatory, nonetheless, provided that the government can come up after the fact, with some kind of post hoc justification, we will not pass on. We will not speak to the discriminatory intent behind the law.
So that brings me to, how far does somebody have to go to signal discriminatory intent and before the justices will say, yeah, this was a discriminatory law?
I think the most troubling part of yesterday's opinion is that there is no good answer to that question.
We are talking about... That was an interesting answer. We were talking about the travel ban decision that the Supreme Court came down with yesterday. We're taking your calls on this, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Aziz Huq, the implications of this ruling, does this ban apply to travel from the U.S. to the seven countries, and talk to us about what seven countries are included.
Well, so the ban applies to nationals of an enumerated set of countries, and the core countries are Iran, Libya, and Syria. There are other prohibitions that apply to Yemenis, for a while it applied to a certain set of people from Chad. It still applies to certain groups of people from Venezuela and from North Korea. The prohibition only applies to people who are coming from those countries, who are nationals of those countries, who are not citizens of the United States or green card holders in the United States. And the operative force of the prohibition is to prevent those people from obtaining, in most cases, a non-immigrant visa, and in some cases, an immigrant visa to visit the United States. So the impact of yesterday's ruling largely falls upon people who are from one of the countries I mentioned, who would want to visit the United States, say as a tourist, or more likely because they have family members here, and upon the U.S. citizens and residents who are the wives, husbands, mothers, children, fathers of people who would want to visit from these countries but now cannot as a consequence of this ban.
You wrote yesterday about how U.S. internment of Japanese Americans during World War II would pass the reasoning of Hawaii versus Trump. How is this so? And also, Justice Sotomayor likened this ruling to Japanese internment, which was also discussed yesterday. Tell me about this.
So in 1944, the Supreme Court ruled in a case called Korematsu that the internment of the Japanese on the West Coast was lawful. And it reached that ruling on the ground that it thought that the reasons that the government had given for the internment were plausible. It didn't say that it had examined those reasons and it had found them deeply compelling. Rather, it said, we are going to defer to the reasons that are given by the government. Everyone in the legal world has long recognized that Korematsu is a morally abhorrent decision, mm-hmm. although there is great controversy or disagreement about why. In yesterday's Supreme Court opinion, Chief Justice Roberts goes out of his way to say, we think that Korematsu was wrongly decided, and we think that it was wrongly decided on the day that it was handed down. So the court is very clear that Korematsu was wrongly decided. The puzzle is, and I think this is the force of Justice Sotomayor's critique, the puzzle is that the reasoning adopted by the majority in Trump v. Hawaii is exactly the same as the reasoning adopted by the Korematsu court. The reasoning is, so long as the government can give us a plausible reason, we are going to turn a blind eye to the otherwise available evidence of Korematsu was rightly decided. One has to ask, well, why? You just did exactly the same thing as the Korematsu court did. You accepted the reasons that were proffered by the government without examining whether they were real reasons, and you turned a blind eye to the weighty and substantial evidence of improper reasons. Korematsu was a case that, in my eyes, and I think in many others' eyes, was a moral abomination because it failed to recognize what was plainly before the justice's eyes.
I'm going to have to stop you there, sir. University of Chicago Law Professor Aziz Huq has been explaining the legal thinking and precedent of yesterday's Supreme Court decision on the travel ban. Professor Huq, it's been a short conversation, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking this hour about the Supreme Court's decision to uphold President Trump's travel ban. We just heard the rationale, or maybe irrationale, for the legal arguments of both the majority and the dissent. Next, we're going to talk about what the travel ban policy means for America's place in the world. What does the Trump versus Hawaii ruling mean for American foreign policy? Do you think that fewer people will come to the U.S. as a result of this decision? Will this hurt us economically? Do you have family members in any of the countries affected by the travel ban? Will you still visit them or wait to see how things shake out and see if you can maybe get back into the country? 800-642-1234 is the number. Ideas@WPR.org is the email. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. David Shanzer is a professor in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University and the director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security. David, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So talk to me about this ban. How does it change things? What did U.S. policy look like before the Supreme Court upheld this ban? And where do we move forward?
Well, the ban has been in place, and the courts actually, Supreme Court actually allowed it to be implemented while this case was being heard in the Supreme Court. So nothing actually is going to change right now. It's been in place. You know, I think the effects are not as immediate and severe as one would think. I think it's really about a long-term erosion of our national standing in the world, a diminution of our soft power, our ability to persuade the world that we are a good and decent country and that people should follow our security and our foreign policy initiatives. I think those are the things that are really going to be damaging because of the implementation of this policy.
You know, people have said that that Obama also had a travel ban, but the issue in this case was that Trump said that he wanted to ban people because of their religion. Is that what you're taking, or did Obama not have a travel ban?
Well, we have to separate a little bit the president's rhetoric from what the ban actually did. Trump did say during the campaign that he wanted to ban all people, all Muslims, from coming to this country, wanted a religious exclusion in our immigration policy. The ban itself was based on nationality, not specifically on religion. You know, either way, I think it's just a departure from our image around the world as a country that is open and welcoming to people who deserve to come, people who are peace-loving, who are have the ability to take care of themselves, who have suffered from the tragedies of war, who are possibly being persecuted. I mean, this is part of our founding. It's part of our national DNA. And I think to abandon that is a huge change in the way we will be perceived around the world.
Is the world changing with us? I mean, I keep reading about Poland and Hungary and Turkey becoming more inward and banning people and reacting to refugees coming through. Is this a global thing that we're just a part of or maybe leading? How does that work?
I think it is a global problem. We have a migrant crisis because of the instability in the Middle East and North Africa. And in the past, I think what we really need is a global solution to try to use diplomacy, whatever powers we have, and to work with other countries to try to settle these regions so they won't be producing so many migrants. I mean, that's the first thing and there's absolutely no effort to do that in the Trump administration. Absent that, I think because of this migrant crisis, it becomes a political issue. Countries feel like their identity is literally being changed by this mass migration. And there's been a political reaction. So the political reaction in Eastern Europe, for sure, some parties in Western Europe gaining power in places like Germany and Italy. And I think we saw that in the 2016 election. Governments unable to kind of articulate how they were going to deal with this large influx of immigrants. Ironically, in the United States, we really actually don't have that. So that's one of the ironies of this policy being implemented.
So interesting, we don't have an influx of immigrants even from Central American countries, because that's what's been all over the news lately.
Well, we have an influx, but the rates of migration are down from Latin America and Mexico. The number of apprehensions were trending down. These policies are being put in place at a time when the trends are actually pointing in the other direction. But that doesn't really matter. It's the public perception.
Right.
And it's been fueled by the hot rhetoric of the president.
We are talking about the Supreme Court's decision yesterday and the effect it'll have on national security. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. David Shanzer, how do we know that this is a security threat? No, let me restate this. There's a travel ban in place. There are fewer people coming to this country from the regions where they're fleeing. Do we know now, since the travel ban is in place, that we are safer? Or are there still national security threats out there that maybe aren't being addressed?
Well, I don't think this policy has any effect whatsoever on the question about terrorism. Let me just give you some numbers. We've had about 275,000 homicides in the United States since 9/11. Only about 150 of those are caused by Muslim terrorists inside the U.S. 150, that's less than 0.1%.
Mm-hmm.
Only a portion of those 150, most of those 150 homicides were caused by all people who are already U.S. Citizens. So even a smaller number for immigrants. And then even a smaller slice of that, very small, from the seven countries on the travel ban. So this is not an anti-terrorism policy. It's not necessary for anti-terrorism. It really was an effort to implement a promise made during the campaign to try to ban Muslim immigration. And I believe it's all political. It has very little to do with security.
So the majority ruled yesterday that there was evidence of legitimate national security concerns with the seven countries who are in this ban, and that those concerns aren't related to religion, despite Trump's tweets and speaking during the campaign. It seems, though, like a few countries are missing from this list. Pakistan, for example, is missing. Saudi Arabia, which the 9/11 hijackers hailed, is missing from this list. Why these seven countries?
Well, as you noted before, a part of it was to base it on something that the prior administration had done to try to show that there was precedent. And what President Obama had done is said that these seven countries, these war-torn countries, there was an enhanced security threat for people immigrating from there. So they were required to show additional evidence before being allowed to travel. And there were additional security measures for those people coming from those countries put into place. But there was no such ban. We still had, in the last year of the Obama administration, 15,000 Syrian refugees come, people who had valid asylum claims from Libya, from Yemen, Somalia, were still able to come, people who had parents or children who from U.S. citizens who wanted to bring their family from those countries were still able to come. So this was a radical departure from what President Obama had done.
So what Obama did was make sure that people were vetted more closely, and what Trump did is say we're not bringing people in at all.
Right. It put a blanket ban with exceptions, although Justice Breyer, in his concurrence yesterday, pointed out that despite the fact that there are exceptions and people are still allowed to come on a case-by-case basis, only three Syrian refugees have been admitted since January of 2017, I believe. And this is what I'm trying to point out in terms of our soft power. And what I mean by that is our ability to kind of stand as a model for the rest of the world that ought to be followed in our efforts to bring peace, in our efforts to prevent nuclear proliferation, in our efforts to do a whole variety, to prevent terrorism, a whole variety of things. If we're not participating with the rest of the world in dealing with the crises around the world and showing ourselves to be a just and humane and a country that cares about the rest of the world, then we're not going to have that kind of power. We've had that since World War II because people emulated our example. But we're setting a terrible example by saying we're only going to, all these people from Syria, we've had 500,000 people have been killed from this war. And we're not a big country like us that hasn't experienced any terrorism or violence from any Syrian refugees. We're not able to open our doors to only three people. I mean, it's tragic. It's tragic.
We are talking about the travel ban decision by the Supreme Court and looking about how it affects national security. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. David Chanzer, you were talking about how we are the leaders in the world, or we've always been seen as the leaders in the world. How are other countries reacting to this decision?
Well, interestingly, if you look at many of the Muslim Arab countries, the governments, a lot of them are getting what they want from the Trump administration, Egypt, Saudi Arabia. They want the United States to have a hardline policy against Iran, and that's what the Trump administration is giving them. And so the governments themselves are quite satisfied with the Trump administration, and probably don't like the idea that there's this ban in place relating to other countries in the region, but willing to look the other way. I'm talking about the global image of the United States, and I just got back from spending 5 months in China, and we are in a large battle for economic and political influence with China around the world. And what is China doing? It's not, having these hot debates about religion and bans on immigration. They're out there, selling infrastructure to countries around the world and throughout the Middle East and Africa and building new relations to help develop trade. And they're trying to, both bolster their economic and political standing around the world. And we're in the process of, closing doors and aligning ourselves with rightist movements in Europe and breaking down the alliance between the United States and our traditional allies in Europe. We're kind of becoming a smaller more petty country, while China is looking more globally. Those are the things I think this is symptomatic of a much deeper problem.
This ruling, does it expand presidential power?
Interesting. The ruling is based on power that Congress gave to the president through the Immigration and Nationality Act. So President Trump couldn't have done this on his own without Congress having had some sort of statutory authorization. So that authorization was interpreted broadly to give the president broad power. So in that extent, over this element of immigration, according to the congressional statute, it did expand the president's power in that regard. But in terms of presidential powers, for example, to bring the country to war or other kinds of, or to conduct surveillance, I don't think it expanded the president's kind of inherent authorities and powers if he's trying to act without any sort of consent from Congress.
And you touched upon this, that this consent from Congress came in the aftermath of 9/11, when a lot of people were really worried about moving power more to the executive branch than the congressional branch.
I think the provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act that were at issue here might have actually been in place before 9/11. I'd actually have to go in and check on that. But you're correct that that's been a very big debate since 9/11. Again, Congress did give the president broader authorities to deal with terrorism and collect surveillance and things like the Patriot Act. But there were controversies relating to the president's power with respect to interrogation and torture and surveillance, which the President Bush actually took actions that were against laws that had been passed by Congress. So that's been a big debate, and including during the Obama administration with President Obama's use of drones, for example, without really specific authorization from Congress. So there's no doubt that since 9/11, there has been an expansion of the presidential power in national security. On a couple of occasions, Congress has risen up and said, you've gone too far and passed laws. But I have to tell you, this is a trend and an issue and a tension. I was actually teaching about it yesterday to some people in the Army. I mean, this is inherent in our founding documents. It's going to be a issue between presidential power and congressional power over national security. For as long as we're a country and have a constitution, and that will continue.
We had a question that came in that asks about functioning governments that will cooperate with us. Without a functioning government, say in Syria or Somalia, it's hard to check people's backgrounds. Was that part of the reason for this ban? And is that a valid argument?
This order went through three iterations, and the first two were so deeply flawed that they were essentially withdrawn. Finally, the administration, to try to, get five votes in the Supreme Court, went through, a valid policy process to say we need to have the governments that can do the vetting, and that's what this is all about, and these seven countries failed the test. And then five justices said that was enough of a policy, national security concern, and process that it deferred to the executive branch.
Okay, the question is, though, if the government isn't working, how can we?
And the question is that valid?
Right.
And it is definitely a fair point. But, we've been accepting, for example, refugees from war-torn countries decades ago from Cambodia and Vietnam, just in the last couple of years from Syria. We do a lot of that vetting ourselves. We work with our international partners, the United Nations. The process for getting Syrian refugees was very, very rigorous.
David, I'm going to have to stop you there. We have been talking to David Shanzer about the national security aspects of the Supreme Court's decision yesterday to uphold the travel ban. He's a professor at Duke University, and he studies terrorism. David, thank you for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Up next, we're going to talk to an activist about policy. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Now we're taking a look at the people most directly affected by this travel ban, Americans with families in those seven countries and the refugees who are struggling to leave. The court majority yesterday said in the text of the ban itself did not mention religion. Dissenters say that Trump himself mentioned his animus toward Muslims during the campaign and that his bias determined his decision over which countries to include in the ban. What do you think of that? Should Trump's tweets and comments outside of travel ban order been considered by the court's majority? Were President Trump's tweets evidence of intentional discrimination? 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our next guest is Warda Khalid. She says refugees desperate to leave some of these countries aren't a threat. In fact, they're a fleeing threat. Warda is the founder of the Polygon organization that aims to increase Muslim American participation in Congress. She works on immigration and refugee issues at Church World Service. Warda, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Oh, that's a great connection. So the Supreme Court ban yesterday, that's what we're talking about. It said that the president's motive was protecting national security. Do you think that that is legitimate?
No, I don't. I would have to agree with the dissenting justice, Sotomayor, who said in her statement that national security was actually used as a facade, and it was a government's misguided invitation to sanction a discriminatory policy towards a disfavored group, that being Muslims, both in the U.S. and abroad. And so she said that the national security claim was superficial, and I would have to agree with that because the data absolutely shows that, you know, Muslim foreigners are not the largest security threat in the United States. It's actually white American men producing domestic terror attacks.
And that is a different show, and I'd love to have you back on that show, too. How does this ban affect refugees and their families who may be still in the United States?
Yes, this ban absolutely affects them. You know, in my work at Church World Service, I hear numerous stories every single day about refugees affected by the ban. So a few months ago, I met with Ahkab Hussein. He's a Somali refugee who spent 25 years living in a refugee camp in Kenya after fleeing the civil war in Somalia, and he was resettled in Ohio. And when he left for the U.S., his wife there was 7 months pregnant, and she had gone through an extensive process to join him in the U.S., security checks, medical checks, the whole shebang. She was cleared to come. But until this day, she has yet to arrive. And now they have a 2-year-old son who Ahkab has actually never met. His name is Abdullah. And because of the travel ban, the Muslim ban, every time, you know, they FaceTime, he asks when he can see his dad. And he hasn't reunited with him. There's so many stories like that. You've got refugees who've got health conditions that are waiting in the camp. They're just waiting to come to the U.S. to get proper medical care. And so it's really, really been devastating for these refugees.
And the people in the U.S. who have family members, can they go visit their families in these countries and be assured that they're going to come back safely? They're not going to be stopped at the airport?
So actually, there is no assurance of that. Yesterday, I was at the Supreme Court. We had a rally after the decision was made. And I was talking to one of my friends, and she mentioned she knew somebody who was Yemeni, who was actually kind of stuck in limbo and was afraid to visit her family in Yemen because she didn't know if she would be able to come back, because the government, you know, now essentially has banned people from entering the United States from Yemen. And so it's been really hard for people, especially a lot of people from Iran as well, are concerned about visiting their family members or having family members visit them. It's been really, really hard. So when you think about family events that you would normally want to get together for, weddings or even funerals or celebrations, those things are not a possibility anymore. It's really heartbreaking.
And people, the ACLU and others, including our guest earlier this morning, Aziz Huq, who is a law professor at the University of Chicago, have compared this decision to Japanese internment camps during World War II. Sonia Sotomayor, said that this is the same thing, that we are doing the same thing that the Korematsu decision legitimized in World War II. What are your thoughts on that?
I absolutely agree with that. You know, a few months before this ruling came down, I actually went to a panel where Fred Korematsu's daughter, Tan Korematsu, spoke about it, you know, her dad's experience as it pertained to the Muslim travel ban, and they absolutely see an analogy, and you saw her and other survivors come out with a statement yesterday opposing this ruling, and it absolutely is comparable because, you know, at that time, we had the Supreme Court, or after the internment happened, this case went to the Supreme Court, and they actually upheld the decision to have state-sponsored internment of 120,000 Japanese-Americans, and again, they were using this excuse of national security. But now, when we look back in 2018 and we think about that the fact that the government, you know, incarcerated that many Japanese-Americans, like, you know, immigrants or people that were, you know, were of Japanese descent, and we think about how terrible that was, and we look at photos from that time, we think about how terrible that was, and that's what's happening here all over again. We just never learned. So I think that decision really put things in perspective in saying that, hey, the Supreme Court may make a decision, but that doesn't mean that decision is necessarily the right one. And in this case, I think that absolutely is true.
It should be pointed out that we were fighting in World War II. We were fighting the Japanese. We were fighting the Germans. We were fighting the Italians. And German and Italian citizens from in the United States were not put in internment camps.
Yes. So, absolutely. There definitely is an element of racism here and xenophobia. And so it absolutely makes sense of why that happened.
So you run a foundation that tries to increase Muslim American participation in Congress, and I would assume other political issues. How is this going to affect what people how people are interfacing with Congress, if they're going to run for office? Is this going to energize people, or is this depressing people?
I think this decision is going to further energize people. People have already been energized since President Trump was elected because of, you know, what he campaigned on, the platform that he campaigned on. There was a xenophobic, bigoted platform in which he said things like Islam hates us and that he wants to ban Muslims from entering the United States. He also criticized people of other, other races. He criticized Mexicans. He criticized the LGBT community, disabled people, women. Every minority group seemed to have a bone to pick with President Trump after that campaign trail. And so it obviously energized people then, and this is further energizing now. And so at Polygon, what we do is we give Muslim Americans and allies the tools to be able to interface with Congress. You know, how do you do a lobby visit? How do you do a town hall meeting? How do you do a phone call? So we give action alerts. We do weekly Hill updates for people. And we provide research, and we also go advocate ourselves on the Hill. And so the purpose behind all this is to make sure that people are holding their members of Congress accountable. And to be quite frank, I did not see that accountability leading up to this decision. You know, some members of Congress made statements, but where was the legislation to rescind this executive order? Where was the effort to block funding for whatever this executive order went into effect? Where are the accountability and oversight measures that Congress needs to have over the administration when it has such a xenophobic and bigoted agenda? So these are the kinds of things that we're going to be working with people to look at, as well as obviously encouraging them to get out there and vote in November. You know, the midterm elections are going to be really important. 100% of the House is up for re-election. And so it's going to be a really important time. So we're actually working on a congressional scorecard to help people make that decision a little bit easier. And so these are all the different ways that we want people to get engaged, because it is so important, and it was very energizing. If you saw the groups out there at the Supreme Court yesterday, there's everyone from Planned Parenthood groups to LGBTQ groups to Muslim advocacy groups to civil rights groups. This is an issue that concerns a lot of different people, and so we are going to be using this as an energizing moment.
We are talking about the Supreme Court's decision yesterday on the travel ban, and we're taking your calls. Barry from Rice Lake, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
One, I just wanted to mention, for at least the third time, I've heard the Japanese internment camp comparison. And I think it hurts the conversation because imprisoning U.S. citizens and people legally in America is not comparable to an immigration policy of not letting a foreign national into the country. It's just, it just hurts the conversation to even discuss that.
And it's not comparable because foreign nationals, you think, are inherently more dangerous? I mean, the argument was that people from Japan actually had relatives back in Japan and that they might be dangerous while we're at war. You don't accept that?
But no, they're citizens or and legally in the United States already. And putting them into a camp or a prison is different from not allowing someone the right to automatically migrate or come to the country without immigration policies being followed. It's just not a comparable thing. One's a citizen and they're here and you're falsely imprisoning them. So it might not feel good to say you can come here, but it's not a comparable situation.
Okay, so thank you, Barry. I think that, Warda, were there immigration policies in place for people from these countries before Trump's travel ban?
Yeah, so Barry, thank you for your question. I'm happy to help clarify. I can speak specifically to the refugee resettlement process. And that's the one that I'm most familiar with. And there absolutely are checks. As I mentioned, with Afkab's wife, she went through numerous security checks to get in place. Refugees, in particular, are the most vetted individuals to enter the United States. No refugee has been involved in a fatal attack on the U.S. soil since the refugee program was started. And so we... To say that these immigrants and refugees coming in need extra checks or we need to stop the process until we figure out what's going on is just duplicative efforts, and it stems from a policy that you cannot deny comes from this racism, xenophobia, Islamophobia, and that is how what makes it comparable to the Japanese internment. And as we mentioned earlier, it's stopping them from seeing their relatives in those countries. And so we have to really dig deep to the root of the problem, to the root of why these policies were put in place, and we can see these similarities. But as far as refugees go, you know, they have interviews with the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, the National Counterterrorism Center. It's a huge multi-step vetting process.
They are vetted. They are vetted. Warda Khalid is the founder of Polygon, an organization that aims to increase Muslim American participation in Congress. She's been talking to us about the travel ban and the fallout. Thank you for being with us, Warda.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have more of The Morning Show in a minute. I'm Carrie Kaufman. You're listening to the Ideas Network.